Welcome to another episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In, recorded on September the 11th, 2024. I'm your host, Robert Sworthell, and I'm joined by my co-host, Andres Sandati. How's it going, Andres?
Good, Robert. I am in Nashville here at the annual FactRight due diligence conference, as I was telling you before we went live. And not a lot on the crypto front here at the conference. Going to be a lot more other alternatives that we're talking about over the next couple of days, but it's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. And is there any sign still up in Nashville from the Bitcoin conference that was in July?
You know, I came straight into the hotel. I am eager to walk around and see if there's any remnants left over. I tell you, Nashville, as everybody knows, that just follows kind of what's booming and what's hot. Like, it's crazy how much development's happened here over the last 10 years. But I'll be looking out for the Bitcoins, the remnants of the Bitcoins.
Yeah, but I imagine they've got all that cleaned up, but you never know. So kind of jump in here. Our first topic is the SEC has warned the FTX estate about stablecoin usage, and specifically, they warned them about using that for disbursements to clients. It's just mind-blowing that they're doing this. Stablecoins are cash equivalent. People were in crypto. To literally, in almost all cases, for people to get stuff on FTX, if they didn't already have crypto, they were probably sending stablecoin there. And ironically, the SEC tried this in the Voyager bankruptcy and also got smacked down by the court. So they're trying a strategy that they already got in trouble for. It's just, you know, it's kind of ironic because it's more of the why provide clarity to the market when threats and other things like that will do is, I guess, the strategy. It's just, it was surprising to see this headline. I kind of thought this was just going to kind of, you know, you go away quietly, but apparently not.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunately more of the same, right? What we've talked about for months on these market updates, the position of the SEC. I mean, I know that we're, you know, going towards a big election in November. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of talk about crypto and digital assets being an issue that could decide, you know, which direction voters go. Mm-hmm. I was really hoping, you know, you've been in this space longer, but I was really hoping that we would start to see more around, you know, what's 25 going to look like in terms of legislation. And I feel like we get a little bit of excitement and we get a little bit of talk, and then, you know, it's sort of back to business as usual. Mm-hmm. And the only real actor that's making any kind of headlines is, you know, the SEC.
Right. And, you know, I was actually talking to someone this morning about this because they were like, you know, you're kind of mixing in the whole political thing. It's like, you know, even if, say, Trump wins the election and Republicans get control of the House and the Senate, which they did with his first term, right? It still took them 2 years to get a tax bill out. It's not like things are going to magically just happen super quick. Right. So we still could be on an elongated timeline, even if, you know, your favorite party wins everything. I don't know. It's I'm trying to be cautiously optimistic, but more cautious than optimistic, probably. So, so our next topic, I found fascinating. So we've talked a little bit about this already, but Ripple will be launching a stablecoin on the XRP ledger that also bridges over to Ethereum. They're calling it RLUSD is the ticker for that particular token. And it's going to be a very similar structure that you have with Tether, or probably more specifically with USDC and Circle. The part that is interesting is you start thinking about how good these businesses are. And the headline that I couldn't find, but I remember the pieces that I think that are important, is last year, Tether showed $6 billion and change of profits with like 40 employees, the biggest stablecoin out there. Obviously, interest rates being high is driving that. BlackRock, with all their employees and all their products, they had a $5 billion profit. Is this crazy how different things can be with the right kind, you know, the right asset at the right time? I think is probably the best way to say it. So Ripple getting in the game, I don't necessarily think it's as much of they're trying to get into the game because they see how good it is for Tether, but more so I think they want a solid stable coin on the XRP ledger. And they say it's coming in weeks. My guess is between now and the middle of October, when they have their big conference, probably leading up to that, we'll have launch so they can talk about something around it. But it's, you know, we'll be interesting to kind of see the uptick and how fast that one grows or doesn't grow.
The, you know, there was a lot of talk in Europe, maybe back to the spring and summer, about some of the stablecoin like legislation there. Have you followed that? I guess that space and that market, because you know we all know mm-hmm. the European legislative agenda and in and around and as it pertains to crypto and digital assets just seems far ahead of mm-hmm. where we're at in the U.S. and we expected that legislation here would start with stable coins. I know there's still things happening around projects like Ripple's, but where are they in Europe?
Well, they're to say they're much further ahead is easy because the U.S. has nothing.
We're at zero.
You're right. But they do have a framework that I think has been in place since January the 1st or July the 1st, one of the two. It's MiCA, M-I-C-A. It does handle cover stable coins. And I know that there's some exchanges in some jurisdictions that are not supporting Tether because it's not MiCA compliant. I don't know the exact ins and outs of why it is or is not compliant. I just know that I remember seeing some headlines, I want to say late spring, early summer, around Uphold, if you were a UK customer, that you were no longer being able to transact in USDT. You know, USDT has come a long way. There used to be no transparency at all. They were like, trust us, we do our own audits ourselves, which obviously is not an audit. And then they have become more transparent, but I don't think they're at the full depth and breadth that at least that the EU regulators want to see. You have good regulations there. You got good regulations in Japan, Singapore, the UAE, and Middle East in general is, you know, all the people that want to be the financial centers of the next 100 years are, you know, oddly enough, ahead of the US here. So here we are.
They've made those countries and the stakeholders have clearly made the determination that we can either protect our turf, you know, in our little agency or our budget, or we can sort of think about collaborating, different branches of government, different regulatory agencies all aligned around this, and then go, you know, frankly, just capture market share and create jobs. So it seems like that's what they're doing.
Yep. And maybe the US can get its head screwed on straight and try to do the same. So staying on the topic of Ripple, it brings us to our third topic here. So kind of going back to the SEC v. Ripple case, we know back roughly a month ago, that's when Judge Torres did her final resolution where she basically said Ripple had to pay $125 million. At that point, either side could start their appeals process to file. They had 60 days to do so. Ripple said publicly they don't plan to. The SEC has not been as clear on that topic, but it seems like they won't appeal. That would be where I'd place my bet at this point. But the news item here is Ripple has asked, because they had Ripple had 30 days to send to the SEC their penalty. I don't know if it's the SEC. Send it somewhere. It's not their money anymore. And they have asked, they requested to the court, and the SEC consented to say that Ripple would have 30 days past the resolution of the case or past the end of the 60-day window if nobody appeals. It's a smart business here. I mean, nobody wants to spend $125 million and then find out that the other side's going to appeal, then that money's hung up. So, you know, this case is slowly going away, it seems, but we are added drama here at the end, I suppose. So.
Yeah. It seems like it's just a matter of when, not if here. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and admittedly, I mean, $125 million makes decent interest these days if you can keep it for a couple months.
Yeah.
So it's real money. Our next topic, you know, this is not something that everybody will use, but I found it cool because this is showing yet another way that crypto is creeping into the financial system, mainstream financial system. So MasterCard is launching a Bitcoin card. That was the headline. And people are like, oh my gosh, it's cool. You'll be able to literally take your MasterCard anywhere that you normally can use a MasterCard, swipe, and at transaction time, they do the behind the scenes. The merchant has no idea you're spending Bitcoin. They do the conversion. I guess if there's a sticker on this one at all, it is, you know, it's to get the card, it's 1.6 euros. Okay, no big deal. It's 1 euro monthly maintenance fee. So that's, you know, it almost starts to feel somewhat like a credit card in the sense there's this fees. And then you have a just shy of 1% transaction fee, 0.95. And that's not too bad. I mean, you go to Coinbase and other places, you're going to be paying 1.5% as a transaction fee. But if you think about it, every time you transact with your card, you're getting the fee. You know, it could add up over time. But it's cool that MasterCard's trying this and trying to reach out. But they claim it'll be available and usable at 100 million merchants worldwide. So,
yeah. So you mentioned Europe. Are they starting the rollout there?
I think it's because the regulations, right? It's clarity. Because, you know, in the U.S., you probably would have the SEC knocking on your door the next day saying, hey, you're selling securities. Or you're transacting in securities, and you probably need some license to do that. So, yeah, they haven't said it's only Europe, but I've only ever seen pricing in euros. So it kind of leads you down that path.
So maybe we could talk about the mechanics. So this would be for somebody who is obviously willing to open up a card with MasterCard. They have a crypto wallet. That crypto wallet, the idea is they go swipe the card use the card, and instantly there's verification that there's Bitcoin in that crypto
the
wallet.
Here is the users get to control the Bitcoin in their own wallet. My understanding. It's not like you're sending it to MasterCard and they're having it as collateral. At the end of the day, it's purely like you're slowly whittling away at your Bitcoin, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that raises a lot of I'm studying for the CFP right now, and there's a whole growing section of study around all the research, behavioral finance effectively, and the whole idea around how somebody's deciding which form of payment to use, and a lot of questions around their view of Bitcoin. There's a lot of sort of behavior and psychology that I think goes into this, because it's different than your typical fiat approach, right? To normal transaction.
To the end merchant, it's a normal transaction. To you, there's a lot of other stuff in your head, right? I mean, you're spending an asset that's volatile. So the idea that you're out buying a coffee, this goes back to, we've talked about this many times. Like, are people willing to transact with crypto that's outside of a stablecoin? Because that you may go to Starbucks and buy an $8 or $10 equivalent coffee. Well, if Bitcoin goes up tomorrow, 50%, all of a sudden that coffee was 50% more, and you don't get 50% more of it.
It's a $14 coffee, and you threw your cup away to get a refill.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I told you about doing a demo with the folks at OnRamp, and one of the things that I was thinking about after that call, and then it's like leading up to this one, is, you know, yes, around this idea of utility, right? And we kind of go back to what we've talked about for some time now at Teton, which is, what is the utility around these digital assets? And, you know, obviously everybody talks mostly about Bitcoin and mostly about Ethereum, and the whole idea of, is there a utility when you start to talk to all the folks in this ecosystem called the industry, right? So the asset managers, the professional service firms, custodians, all these providers of services who are generally starting, in many cases, you know, if they're thinking about retail, meaning the individual investor, like, they're typically starting with something around Bitcoin, or services to support your Bitcoin, whether it be custody or wallets, etc. And then, you know, the idea is you're going to hopefully do more. But yeah, this whole question of, you know, you set up a MasterCard, is somebody going to go, and when the whole idea around Bitcoin is, I'm never selling, for some people, like, it's like, I've heard this analogy of, it's like owning, you know, Midtown Manhattan. Like, you would never want to sell that. Like if you own real estate in Midtown Manhattan, you would just hold it long term, you know? And so this idea that no, you know, there's actually the ability to go and, you know, buy dinner or pay for a movie. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see this project and how it goes.
Yeah. You know, and it could be a test. It could be a real thing, but it starts to, you know, allow people the thought of being sovereign with their money. You know, there's not too much freedom as it is now, but start being able to use crypto in those kind of cases. You know, what is a much better example is, you know, just being able to transact in whatever you want. The merchant doesn't care and they get what they want. That to me becomes a crypto world. And it, you know, if you're a world traveler, you don't have to worry about what currency they care about, and it just happens.
You're not stopping at the window at the airport. It's got 30 currencies
to get ripped off.
You pay 40% in fees.
You knowingly walk up to get ripped off. Those days are maybe coming to an end. Yeah. Maybe, probably in the more distant future, but they certainly can happen. So, our next topic, is kind of a bit of a reflection. So the Bitcoin and Ethereum ETFs have been out for, you know, a couple months or most of the year if in Bitcoin's case. And admittedly, we've kind of hinted at this on a couple other episodes, but they couldn't be more different in their performance. You know, even if you look at now, Bitcoin is up 30% since its ETF launched and Ethereum is down 30%. So, you know, that's more of the whole market. Crypto goes how the stock market goes. If there's not expansion happening in the stock market, crypto is not going to do well. It seems to be basically directly correlated to that. And but, you know, if you put a stake in the sand right now, obviously maybe the Ethereum launch wasn't the best time. The Ethereum one also has the problem of it doesn't have a marketing plan besides just being second to market. So.
Yeah. I mean, welcome to the volatile world of crypto, right? I mean, you couldn't have more sort of opposite extremes, and and there's no way that you can look at, you can't look at these and say, you know, like much of the stock market today, or at least the S&P 500, much of it is dominated by the performance of a handful of sort of mega cap now, not even large cap, but just mega cap technology companies, you know? And so when you look at the two giant mega caps, if you will, in crypto, in terms of, you know, if you talk about it in market cap terms, Bitcoin, Ethereum, the performance is totally asymmetric. Like, I don't know what Nvidia's chart looks like so far this year. I assume it's up and to the right, and percentage wise, it's probably one of the best performing stocks, if not
the best,
the best performing stock of those mega caps. But I would also think that, you know, the other ones, Meta, Google, Amazon, others are probably having a you know, pretty solid years as well. Not the case with crypto.
Correct. You know, and, you know, but the conversation I was having this morning, I was telling the guy that I think that if this was a normal bull market cycle, we would potentially be doing better than we are right now. I just think that this political season has been so crazy and it has taken up all the news. And you had this buildup of 4 years of the SEC acting like they have with crypto. It will not just the SEC, but the government in general. And it's kind of a wait and see approach, I think, that's kind of happening in crypto. It's, you know, I guess everyone's probably ready for November to be here. And I think the crypto
industry. I'm going to be devil's advocate for a minute, but I feel like there's a lot of, this is going to be different in crypto. Like if we could just get legislation or if we could just get regulatory clarity, in your experience and in the time you've been in crypto and looking at these cycles, is, you know, everybody was saying, well, maybe when the ETFs open up and that's going to bring a bunch of new capital into the space, or maybe when we get past FTX and all the scams, has the legislation or the lack of regulation been there all along as the single big driving issue to increase adoption, to increase liquidity and capital into into the space?
I would say so, but like it ebbs and flows how big of a headline it is.
Yeah.
But it's certainly probably always been the top three headlines if you kind of took a sample of stuff.
Yeah.
And at least in my perspective, all the good things that crypto has a promise for will not happen without regulation. You can have all the meme coins, all that kind of stuff, but you don't need a meme coin to have regulation. It is what it is. But for some of these other tokens to be used and touched by businesses, or, you know, used to improve the back office efficiency for something that's retail focused, at the end of the day, it's regulation that's holding it up. And then you magnify that with what's happened in the last 3.5 years with this administration and their attack on crypto, specifically the SEC. And then you got Choke Point 2.0 that still continues to happen. It's an assault on an industry that, admittedly, I don't know if there's a great example of something else that's happened like that in the past.
I know you have long been in technology and built multiple businesses in software. And so I highly value your perspective and certainly your experience much, much greater than mine in this domain. But my question would be, when the internet initially was in its, you know, very early stages, I mean, it was a government research project, and then it grew from that.
That's when Al Gore invented it.
Right. And then Al Gore invented it. Then we really, consumers, like mainstream folks, really started to sort of experience the internet in the 90s, right?
Yeah, late 90s. Yeah.
Mid to late 90s. And then things really took off and accelerated in like a 2-year period, you know, or several year period. And then you fast forward 20 years or so from, you know, from the 2000.com crash. And would you say that regulation, because there was a lack of it, and the government really stayed out of the way largely, with the exception of the big Microsoft case, you know, the antitrust case. Now there's a big, you know, a couple of big antitrust cases. But do you think that the internet and everything around it, all the growth and everything that's happened as a result of the internet, social media and Web 2.0, is that all because of a lack of regulation? Or is it because it's not directly tied to money?
To money. And, both.
The lack of certainty around, is this another FTX? Or is this another, you know, Google? And not that Google hasn't made some mistakes, but largely, I mean, those two guys created what we now know is like this modern search, and created an advertising behemoth, you know, on the backside of that.
I think it's both. I think it's more so that it wasn't like there was no regulation. Oddly enough, regulators did a very good job in hindsight of being light touch with the regulation. And being willing to change over time. But you're right. It didn't touch money. And that maybe is very dear to a government, right? It's kind of how, in some sense, how it controls people. So you have that added with it's on top of the internet, and maybe with hindsight, I don't know. There's I think a lot of agendas mixed up in this, unfortunately. And you just have a recipe for a bit of a negative perfect storm here. So
I'm just curious how much the big giant central players in the global financial system, right, the giant banks, the giant asset managers, the giant insurance, like if they really got together in a room, you know, I mean, this is not likely, but you know what I mean, like they wanted to save the global financial system when long-term capital management had massive leverage on, you know, for people that don't know that story, it was a hedge fund, supposedly, you know, some of the smartest minds in finance got together, started a hedge fund, and it nearly crippled and took down the financial system. And literally like 12 guys got together with the Federal Reserve and like
figured it out
with a rescue. Came up with a rescue plan. Right. Yeah. I mean, we saw some of that in, you know, 08, right. Where this they made movies about this shit, like where people got together and it was like all of a sudden, okay, we're going to rescue Bear Stearns and, you know, JP Morgan's going to get, you know, backstop. And it's like, I don't know. It seems like harder shit's been figured out. But we still continue to feel like take one step forward and like one regulator decides, no, we're going to go this direction. And then you throw the political season into that and it's a recipe for agendas slowing down potential progress, I guess.
Yeah. And I guess the last thing I would say on this piece is you've had literally the world's biggest asset manager in BlackRock, Larry Fink, leading up to basically all the way through the end of 23, being crypto is not good, crypto, you know, all the negative things about it, never said a positive. Then all of a sudden, they were ready. All of a sudden, he is not the biggest Bitcoin cheerleader, but he's pretty high up the list at this point. Yeah. And only can say positive things. So I don't know. I've kind of learned to pay attention to what they do, not what they say.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said. Yeah. Yeah. We, yeah, well, we digress, but I thought it was worthwhile to sort of explore, mm-hmm. given, you know, the political season we're in, but also just, I think you have to take a temperature check every once in a while and say, right. I mean, obviously we are long-term the space and believe the potential of the space. Hopefully the market begins to recognize things like utility, and over time you start to see more of these institutional type projects take grip. But I think, yeah, big uncertainty whether or not regulation provides, whether it's a backstop that companies need or it's certainty, that's a big deal in business.
Yep. Well, I kind of alluded to it, but our last point, BlackRock, their IBIT Bitcoin ETF is now holding 2% of all Bitcoin that will ever be in existence. So going from not liking Bitcoin to holding 2% in just over 8 months is pretty incredible.
Yeah. What's your take on that?
Great marketing, good sales force, cause their product that they're selling is no different than the other seven that are out there outside of small differences in fees. But when you are the biggest name and I guess air quotes most trusted, you tend to attract a lot, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I mentioned to you, I was on a call earlier this week, start getting more acquainted with a platform called OnRamp and some of the things that they provide around custody. And they also have an asset management business. But as you know, like running a wealth advisory firm, like one of the things that I'm trying to do more of is just like more ground level research. Because I think, you know, there are people that, given all the uncertainty and all the stuff we talked about today, there are people out there who want to get exposure. They want to get exposure, and there's a lot of different ways now to do that. Obviously, the ETFs, to your point, BlackRock's clearly won some of those folks over. There's also a variety of other ways to do it. And I think, you know, like part of me is like, hey, I hope a lot of advisors never do wake up to the potential in this space. Yeah. But I have a feeling I'll be, you know, that's wishful thinking. Although I do think that there's the ability to get rewarded for being early. But as a fiduciary, I think your obligation is to be informed, right? And obviously to do no harm. So I think you got to do the work. But part of me is like, you talk about the space and the potential of the space, and you sort of come back to these themes around, when are we going to get clarity? When are we going to get regulation? And then I think, and it's could be easy for somebody to say, we're not making headway. Look at prices, but I think if you also zoom out and you look at what happened with the internet, and you look at what happened with some of these areas, you know, just take AI. I mean, it's on the scene now.
Absolutely.
Hundreds of billions of dollars being invested. There's pioneers that have been working in that space for decades. Mm-hmm. And now the mainstream folks, you know, want to own NVIDIA. So
yeah, it's an overnight success.
That's right. We love that in America.
Yes, yes. That's awesome. Cool. Well, we'll wrap it up here. So thanks for joining us on this episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In. If you want to stay updated on future episodes, you can find us in any podcast player by searching Teton Crypto Capital or the Weekly Crypto Check-In. Take care.